Chapter 5.
Had I found that all of you were rushing to make war on the Romans, and not that the purest and sincerest part of the populace were preferring to make peace, I would neither have come to you here, nor been so bold as to give you counsel. For any speech in support of the necessary policy is superfluous whenever all the hearers unanimously favor the worst course. But I see that some are stirred up because of their young age, inexperienced in the evils which accompany war, and that some are stirred up by an irrational hope of freedom, and a few by a certain greed. And from the profits of those who are weaker in the event that your affairs become confounded. So, in order to recall these very persons to their senses and reverse their course, and that the good citizens might not reap the harvest of the ill counsel of a few, I thought it proper to gather all of you together in the same place to tell you what I consider to be for your benefit. But let no one create a disturbance against me if what he hears is not to his liking. For those who have begun rushing incurably into the rebellion will, following my exhortation, still have the liberty to retain their same sentiments. But unless you all keep silent, my words will fall to the ground, even for those who wish to hear them. Therefore, I know that there are many who are waxing tragic on the abuses of the procreators, and with encomiums on freedom. But before scrutinizing who you are and against whom you are undertaking to make war, I shall first unravel this entanglement of pretexts. For if, on the one hand, you are avenging yourselves on those who are causing you injury, why do you extol freedom? If, on the other hand, it is slavery you consider intolerable, then blaming the commanders is superfluous. For even if they were showing restraint, being a slave would still be equally shameful. But closely examine how minute the case is for making war, even on the grounds of each of these arguments. First, as for the accusations against the procurators, it is necessary to cultivate and not provoke the authorities. But whenever you fashion exaggerated reproaches for minor shortcomings, you only prosecute the objects of reproach to your own detriment. For, after ceasing to harm you covertly, they, with shame, ruin you openly. There is nothing which repels the blows as well as tolerating them. And the quietness of those being injured becomes a distraction to those who cause injury. But let us take it for granted that the Roman underlings are incurably harsh. It does not follow that all Romans have injured you. Certainly not Caesar, against whom you are choosing war! For it is not by their instructions that any worthless governor has come to us. Nor are those from the Evening Land in the west looking closely upon those under the rising sun in the east. Nor, indeed, is it easy for them there to quickly hear reports from here. Now it is perverse to make war against many on account of one, to do so against such great people on account of trifling causes, and especially when they do not even know what we are blaming them for. And what we complain about might indeed be swiftly rectified, for the same procurator does not remain forever. And it is probable that the successors to come will be more restrained. But once a war has been ignited, it is not easy either to lay it down or to sustain it without calamities. Certainly the longing for freedom is now untimely. It would have been necessary to have struggled in the past so that it might never have been thrown away. For the experience of slavery is indeed harsh, and the struggle to avoid it is righteous. But the one who has once been subdued and then resists is not a lover of freedom, but an obstinate slave. Accordingly, at that time, when Pompeius was setting foot in the region, it would have been necessary to do everything to prevent the Romans from being admitted. But our fathers and their kings, who are better positioned than you in finances and in bodies and in souls, did not hold out against even a small portion of the Roman force. And yet, you, who have inherited submission as a tradition, who are so much more inferior in your affairs than those who first submitted themselves, are setting yourselves against the entire Roman Empire? And the Athenians, in order to preserve the freedom of the Hellenes, at one time consigned their city even to fire. And when the arrogant Xerxes had sailed across the land and made a footpath across the sea, not yielding to the depths, but leading the army that was broader than Europa, they pursued him like a fugitive on a single ship, and broke Asia so mighty near tiny Salamis. Even they are now slaves to the Romans, and the city which is the commander of Helada is administered by orders sent from Italia. And the Lacedaemonians, after Thermopylae and Plataea, and after Agesilaus had explored Asia, are content to serve the same masters. And the Macedonians, though still conjuring up Philippus and envisioning their domination of the inhabited earth being disseminated by Alexandrus, tolerate such a great reversal and bow down before those whom fortune has advanced. But there are tens of thousands of other nations who, swelling with greater pride in the assertion of their liberty, have nevertheless yielded. Will you alone scorn to be slaves of those who have subdued everything? In what sort of army, in what sort of arms do you depend on? Where is your force that will seize the Roman seas? And where are the treasuries that will be fully sufficient for the offensives? Do you suppose, as it seems, that you are igniting this war against Egyptians or against Arabians? Will you not fully survey the Roman Empire? Will you not take the measure of your own feebleness? Have we not often been weaker even than the neighboring nations, while the Roman strength is invincible throughout the entire inhabited earth? Not only this, but they sought something even more than this. For the whole Euphrates on the east is not at all sufficient for them, nor the East Roads of the north, not even Libya on the south, which has been explored all the way to the uninhabited regions of the earth, and Gadir on the west. Not only this, but they sought another inhabited earth beyond Oceanus, and they carried their arms all the way to the previously unexplored Britons and Germans. What then? Are you richer than the Galatians? Stronger than the Germans? More intelligent than the Hellenes? More numerous than everyone throughout the inhabited earth? What persuasive force has propelled you against the Romans? Someone will say, being a slave is painful. How much more for the Hellenes? For they are the first in nobility of all those under the sun. And although they have a great region apportioned among themselves, they give way to 6 bundles of Roman rods. The Macedonians also give way to the same number. Whose reason to contend for freedom is more righteous than yours? And what about the 500 cities of Asia? Do they not bow down before one commander and the consular bundle of rods? And this even without a garrison. Need I speak of the Hemiochians and the Colchians and the people of the Tauri, Bosporons, but also the nations dwelling around the Pontos and the Myotis? In the past, not a single master of their own was recognized among them. But now they are subject to 3,000 heavy-armed men, and 40 longships pacify the formerly unnavigable and wild sea. How much do Bithynia and Cappadocia and the Pamphylian nation, Lucians and Cilicians, have to say in behalf of freedom? For they are subject to tribute even without arms. And what about the Thracians, who have seized a region 5 days in breadth and 7 in length, but more rugged than yours, and extremely more secure, able to drive back attacking armies with its deep frost? do they not submit to 2,000 Roman guards? And after these, the Illyrians, who inhabit the region as far as Dalmatia and are cut off by the Estros, do they not give way to only 2 legions, by which they themselves drive back the assaults made by the Dacians? And the Dalmatians, who have so often reared their manes to toss off the yoke for the sake of freedom, and for this reason alone, whenever they had been subdued in those days, they always marshaled their strength to rebel again. Yet do they not keep quiet under a single Roman legion? Moreover, if there are any people who might be understandably provoked by certainly great circumstances towards rebellion, it should obviously have been the Galatians, who have been walled off by nature in the following way. On the east by the Alps, on the north by the Rhenos River, on the south by the Pyrenean Mountains, and on the west by Oceanus. But although they have been encompassed by such great defences, and abound with 305 nations, and have, as one might say, the springs of prosperity within the country itself, and their goods flood nearly the whole inhabited earth, they tolerate being revenue to the Romans, and serving as a paymaster for their very own domestic prosperity. And they put up with this not because of any softness in aspirations or lack of nobility, having persevered in war for 80 years in behalf of freedom, but in connection with the Romans' power and being astonished at their fortune, which brings them success more than their arms. Therefore, that is why they are slaves under 1,200 soldiers, when they have almost more cities than that. Nor, with the Iberians, did the gold which was being dug up suffice at all for the war in behalf of freedom. Nor could such a great distance by land and sea from the Romans suffice for the Ares mad people of the Lusitanians and Cantabrians. Nor did neighbouring Oceanus suffice, even while inflicting a surging tide which frightens even the locals. Not only this, but after extending their arms beyond the Pillars of Hercules and traversing the Pyrenean Mountains through the clouds, the Romans also enslaved these people. And a single legion was a sufficient garrison for these, who were so hard to fight and living so remote. Who is there among you who has not heard about the horde of Germans? No doubt you have often seen the strength and size of their bodies, since the Romans have their captives everywhere. But these men, although they apportion a boundless land among themselves, and who have aspirations bigger than their bodies, as well as a soul which scorns death, and who have tempers more fierce than those of the wildest beasts, have the Rhenos as a boundary for their impetuosity. And being dominated by 8 Roman legions, those who have been conquered are slaves, while their nation as a whole is preserving itself by flight. And now, you who depend on the walls of Jerusalem, also consider the wall of the Britons. For the Romans sailed there and enslaved even those people who are surrounded by Oceanus and who inhabit an island no smaller than our part of the inhabited earth. And four legions now closely guard such a big island. And need I say much more, when even the Parthians, that most warlike people who are chiefs of so many nations and have equipped themselves with such a large force, send hostages to the Romans. And in Italia it is possible to see, with peace as its justification, the nobility of the East serving in slavery? Now, while almost everyone under the sun is bowing down before the Romans' arms, will you alone go to war? And this, without considering the fate of the Carthaginians, who, though boasting of the great Hannibal, and of their nobility from the Phoenicians, fell beneath the right hand of Scipio. Neither have the Cyrenians, Lacedaemonians by ancestry, nor the Marmaridae, the people extending all the way to the parched land, nor the Sirtians, frightening even to those hearing about them, nor the Nasamones, nor the Maurians, nor the countless mass of Numidians, been able to resist the Romans' exploits. And they have subdued this entire third part of the inhabited earth, whose nations are not easily enumerated, and which is marked off by the Atlantic Sea as well as the Pillars of Hercules, and sustain the countless Ethiopians as far as the Red Sea. But apart from their annual harvests, which feed the masses in Roma for 8 months, they are additionally subject to every kind of tribute, and they hand over their prepared tax levies for the services of the imperial power. Nor do they, like you, consider any of the orders to be an outrage, even though a single legion remains with them. And why is it necessary to show you far-off examples of the Romans' power, when it is easy to learn it from neighboring Egypt? It extends all the way to Ethiopia and Arab Felix, and is a harbor for the Indian region. And it has 7,500,000 people, besides the inhabitants of Alexandria, as may be clearly proven from the tax levy on each head. Yet it does not scorn the Roman Empire. Although it has Alexandria as a great spur for rebellion, both on account of its mass of men and wealth, and due to its size, its length being 30 stadia, and its breadth no less than 10. Yet it hands over more tax to the Romans in 1 month than you do in a single year. Not only this, but besides the money, it supplies grain for Roma for 4 months. And it is walled off on every side, either by impassable deserts, or by harbourless seas, or by rivers, or by marshes. But none of these barriers has been found stronger than the Romans' fortune. And two legions stationed in the city bridle both deeper Egypt together with the nobility of the Macedonians. Therefore, where will your auxiliaries come from? From the uninhabited regions? Certainly all those in the inhabited earth are Romans. Unless some of you extend your hopes beyond the Euphrates and suppose that your compatriots from Hadib are joining the defense. But they will not embroil themselves with so serious a war for such an irrational cause. Nor would the Parthian grant permission to anyone who had decided to take such ill counsel. For he shows concern for maintaining the truce with the Romans. And if one of those under him were to move against the Romans, he would regard it as violating that treaty. Therefore, all that remains to resort to is the assistance of God. But this too has been marshaled on the side of the Romans. For without God, it is impossible to put together such a formidable domination. But consider how hard it will be to manage the purity of your religious practices, even if you were to make war on easy victims. For how can you hope to have the assistance of God on your side, if by being compelled to violate these very things on which you fervently place this hope, you make him turn away from you? Certainly, by observing the custom of the seventh day, and by initiating no activities whatsoever on it, you will be easily conquered, exactly as your fathers were by Pompeius, who was especially active for the siege on these days, on which the besieged were inactive. But if you are violating the ancestral law in the war, I fail to understand what object you have for further hostilities, when your one aim is not to relinquish anything of your fathers. But how will you call upon the deity for defense when you have willingly violated your devotion towards him? Now all those who embark on war have come to trust in either divine or human assistance. But whenever probability cuts off both, those who make war are choosing evident capture. Therefore, what is there preventing you from executing your children and women with your own hands, and from incinerating this most exceptionally beautiful homeland? For by behaving madly in this way, you will at least spare yourselves the reproach of defeat. Friends, as long as the boat is still in port, it is noble to first consider the impending winter storm, and not to be put into the middle of squalls to perish. For those who fall into unforeseen terrors are at least to be pitied. But the one who had rushed into foreseen destruction attracts only reproaches. But if anyone imagines that you can make war according to some treaty, and that the Romans will show restraint after taking control of you, and will not, as an example to the other nations, both incinerate the holy city and do away with your entire people. Know that if you do survive, you will find no place of refuge, since everyone has, or is afraid to have, the Romans as their masters. But the danger is not only for those who are here, but also for those residing in the other cities. For there is not a population in the inhabited earth who does not have a portion of us among them. If you go to war, our enemies will massacre all of them. Because of the ill counsel of a few men, every city will be filled with Judean slaughter. And pardon will surely come to those who have done this. But if it does not take place, consider how impious it would be to move arms against those who are so benevolent. Therefore, have compassion, if not on your children and women, at least on this metropolis and the sacred precincts. Spare the temple and preserve the inner sanctum for yourselves, along with what is holy. For after taking control of these, the Romans will no longer hold back, since they have been shown ingratitude in exchange for having previously spared them. For I myself call to witness your holy things and the sacred messengers of God and our common homeland, that I have not betrayed anything conducive to your safety. And if you will take counsel to do what is necessary, you will hold the peace in common with me. But if you continue to be led on by your impetuosity, you will face the peril without me.
When he had spoken these things in this way, both he and his sister wept. Through these tears, he repressed much of the multitude's violence. But they continued to cry out that they were not at war with the Romans, but instead with Florus, on account of what they had suffered from him. At this, King Agrippa declared,
"But these actions are the same as making war with the Romans. For you have not given your tribute to Caesar, and you have severed the colonnades of Antonia. Therefore, if you reattach these colonnades and also pay your tax levies, you will unload the responsibility of the revolt. For the fortress certainly does not belong to Florus, nor will you be giving the money to Florus."
The populace was persuaded by these words, and, along with both the king and Berenike, they went up into the temple in order to begin the reconstruction of the colonnades. But both the chiefs and the counselors were assigned to the villages in order to collect the taxes. Now they quickly gathered the 40 talents, for that is how much tax remained. And Agrippa indeed suppressed the threat of the war at that time. But he kept endeavoring again to persuade the multitude to submit to Florus until a successor was sent by Caesar to replace him. At this, They were provoked and reproached the king and proclaimed his banishment from the city. But some of the insurgents even ventured to throw stones at him. Now the king saw that the passion of the revolutionaries was uncontrollable and was very embittered that he had been trampled in the mud by them. Indeed, he sent their chiefs, along with the powerful men, to Florus at Caesarea in order that Florus might appoint some of their number to levy tribute on the country, while Agrippa himself withdrew to his own kingdom.